As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ore Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Thanks in part to clashes between gangs, there are many missing people in Mexico. So many, in fact, that it's hard to put a number on it. The country's president says he's trying, but those still looking for their relatives say that he's actually working to make the problem itself disappear. And while lotteries are becoming increasingly popular among the people who can least afford them. But first, Kharkiv, in the northeast of Ukraine, is the country's second largest city, just 30 kilometers from the border with Russia. And it is bearing the brunt of Russia's military offensive. Missiles, drones, and bombs have hit a wide variety of targets, including electricity infrastructure, meaning that rolling blackouts are back again. In just one incident, about a week ago, a drone struck an apartment building, an event devastating in its own right. But Russia then conducted what's known as a double-tap attack, waiting until rescuers have arrived on the scene before hitting it again. Two residents are believed to have died in the attack, along with three firefighters. And overnight, Kharkiv was rocked yet again. Russia wants to demoralize the city's population. And so Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, did what he's done many times before.
Дорогі українці, українки, сьогодні Харків, Харківщина.
Багато питань. Earlier this week, from a sunny street in Kharkiv, he recorded a public message saying that he was proud of its people, that he was there to oversee the construction of fortifications around the city. But will those efforts be enough to keep the Russian ground forces at bay?
The mood in the city is quite strange and peculiar. People, they're exhausted, they're angry.
Oli Carroll is the Ukraine correspondent for The Economist, and he's just returned from Kharkiv.
And since the start of the war, approaching a third of all aerial attacks have been on Kharkiv. Currently, there's a sense of foreboding that Russia is stepping up those operations and that Kharkiv is uniquely vulnerable. But couples are walking in parks despite missiles landing nearby. People are playing football, diving to the ground whenever there is an attack, as just was the case this week. Unbreakable spirit, something which is bandied around quite a lot, but here it's quite a good descriptor.
Oli, what exactly are the people of Kharkiv up against?
Well, it's been pretty relentless since December. Waves of drones, ballistic missiles, and just recently, in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a new type of weapon being used against Ukraine's second city, guided bombs. These are aerial bombs which can be thrown from tens of kilometers by Russian planes. They're taking out transformers. Power generation was practically nullified in Kharkiv at the end of March. It's not a place for the faint-hearted.
Civilians are facing a renewed aerial campaign this far into the war. Now, from what you saw, how is that affecting their daily lives?
The answer to that question is it depends. To get one extreme side of the picture, I actually went to the site of the first of these guided aerial bombs, just slightly outside of the city centre on 23rd August Street, at a tired-looking apartment block just across the road from a supermarket called Chuda, the Miracle. And that's where I met Irina Timokina, who at this point was drinking tea on a park bench that for the last 3 days has basically been her living room.
Так у всех. Что-то вылетело, что-то осталось.
So at the park bench, she was basically describing the scene, the dust and the glass which are now covering her apartment. The fine glass which is covering every piece of furniture. It's not big chunks, she can't even clean it up. But at the same time, she said she's alive and she has a roof over her head. Though when we finished and looking back, we could probably say only just. In several waves of attacks since that March the 27th aerial bomb, there have been at least 16 killed. Another 50 injured, according to reports from local news sources. What was interesting about Irina was she herself is from Russia. She was born in Grozny, Chechnya, and she curses Vladimir Putin, says she's hated Russians for a long time. She calls them zombified morons, and this includes members of her own family. What she says is that she's lived in Ukraine for 43 years. And she's found there a sense of freedom that she could never find in Russia. For that reason, she's never wanted to go back. A particular hatred for the city equidistant from the border on the Russian side, Belgorod, which is where the majority of missiles are launched from. Irina said she would like to see the city raised from the earth. Strong language, but it's hardly a minority opinion in Kharkiv these days.
Irina has chosen to stay, but surely not everyone has.
No, certainly not. Kharkiv, at its height, was about 2 million strong. It was always a big student town. Perhaps 300,000 or 400,000 of that population were international students. At the height of war in 2022, when Russia was essentially pummeling the city, the population went down to about 300,000. We're now back up to about 1.3 million. People have returned. The city is pretty calm, but at the same time, certainly some people and some of the businesses that haven't left are thinking of leaving. I spoke to another Irina Volchuk, a journalist and former doctor, over Zoom from Europe. She left at the end of March when she said, essentially, her nerves could no longer take it. She'd got used to the regular threats, but in the moment a rocket landed 100 metres from her flat, that was the moment she said enough. She'd started experiencing panic attacks, and she said she needed to prioritise her own health and leave. Leaving the city felt like leaving a friend behind, she says. And she's not the only one in Kharkiv who feels that way towards the city.
Oli, what is the goal here? Russia tried to capture the city earlier in the war. Are they trying to do it again?
The truth is, we can't say for certain. But what we can say is Russia is preparing for a major new attack in the summer. Sources with knowledge of the intelligence picture told me that they're currently preparing 6 divisions in eastern Siberia. That's about 120,000 troops. Just earlier this month, President Zelensky also said that Russia is planning to mobilize as much as 300,000 soldiers in addition to that. But is Kharkiv going to be the main focus for that attack? Probably not. That is more likely to be Donetsk and Lugansk. This is the political goal that the Kremlin has stated on many occasions, and it would probably be a more achievable military task. The Russian army would certainly find it incredibly difficult, likely impossible, to take Ukraine's second city. The last time they tried in 2022, it was a moment when the city was far less defended, and they failed spectacularly. But the fear is that not being able to take Kharkiv, Putin will settle for the next best thing, in his view, which would be to make the city completely unbearable to live in.
What are local leaders saying?
So I spoke to the mayor, Igor Terekov, in a secret location in the industrial area of the city. And he said that his city has no intention of giving up. He said that people won't leave. Many of them have already left and come back already. Lots of people who are in Kharkiv have made Kharkiv their home as a conscious decision. They're pro-Ukrainian, they're pro-Kharkiv. And the sense of digging in, I suppose, is best summed up by the city's decision to start building some of its schools underground. And the first of these is opening just now. If the rest of the world has written Kharkiv off, the residents of Kharkiv clearly have not received that memo. It's impossible to break us, they tell us. The mayor said the challenge of powering up a city without power stations or transformers was difficult, but they've managed it. He also said rather pointedly that many of the city's problems would be solved if essentially the West provided capable air defense systems or F-16s, which would be able to push back the fighter jets that are carrying these new bombs. From my sources, I understand that Russia has destroyed at least some of the Western-supplied Patriot air defense systems that Ukraine had been using to protect cities like Kharkiv. There simply aren't enough of them to go around. We've seen what Russia has done in places like Aleppo, in Mariupol. Every Kharkiv citizen knows the threat. But at the same time, whenever you visit Kharkiv, you get the sense of immense pride for the city and a pride for wearing the badge of Ukraine's indomitable fortress. What they need is more air defense. Will they get it in time? That's the big question.
Oli, thank you so much for your time.
It's always a pleasure.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.
Un censo. Nuevo.
This is President Andrés Manuel López Obrador speaking last June.
Plena certeza de cuántos desaparecidos hay realmente.
When he announced a new census of the disappeared people that he said he hoped would allow Mexicans to be completely certain about how many missing people there really are.
Y está participando la subsecretaría de Gobernación.
Sarah Burke is the Economist's bureau chief for Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean.
In December, at the end of last year, his government declared the results of the new census.
Después de estas dos en la base de datos de 110,000, tenemos también 24%, 26,000.
And the government said that just over 12,000 of the almost 111,000 people in the register were definitely confirmed as missing.
A partir del 1 de mayo de 2023, la estrategia nacional de búsqueda.
Mexico as a country is plagued by this problem of what they call the disappeared, but many people don't agree with the government's new numbers.
Sarah, tell me about those people that don't agree. What do they say?
So I spoke to one woman called Maria Isabel Cruz in Sinaloa, which is a state in the northwest of Mexico.
Entonces desde hace 7 años, mi hijo acaba de cumplir 7 años desaparecido, tenía 28 años.
Her son disappeared in 2017 and she's been looking for him ever since.
Estaba a punto de casarse, dejó una novia, un vestido, una fiesta inconclusa.
He had a girlfriend, he was about to get married. He was only 28. She says it hurts her soul that he's still missing and she doesn't know what's happened to him.
Y sigo buscándolo, ¿no?
Maria told me that she expected the government to push down the numbers, but not by that amount. She and many others say that many missing people just don't show up in the records. So to say there are only 12,000 missing people, or just over, just doesn't tally with what's happening on the ground.
¿Cómo es posible que de 112,000 personas desaparecidas solo haya 12,000 personas en el país? O sea, es ilógico.
She and others say that the government is disappearing the disappeared.
Que está desapareciendo a los desaparecidos.
Even with reports of undercounting, though, 12,000 people is still a lot. Sarah, why are there so many people missing in Mexico?
I mean, this is a real tragedy in Mexico. The number of people going missing, and that means they've been reported missing but we haven't found a body, shot up after Felipe Calderón's government launched a so-called war on drugs in 2006. This caused gangs to splinter, resulting in horrific violence and murders and clashes, and they're probably responsible for most of the missing people. During Mr. Calderon's six-year term, an average of 8 people went missing every single day. But since Mr. López Obrador took power in 2018, that's risen to 1 every hour. Now, some of that increase may well be down to an improved reporting system. Mexico's only relatively recently sorted out techniques to register these people. But security has also deteriorated under Mr. López Obrador. He's taken a rather passive approach, and that's empowered the gangs. Most of the missing people are almost certainly dead. Since 2018, at least 2,710 clandestine graves, and these are massive graves, have been found in Mexico. And there are over 50,000 unidentified bodies in government facilities.
And obviously, this is a bad look for the president.
Yeah, I mean, many people you talk to say this is why the government carried out the new census, that the president was annoyed when it became clear that the number of people disappearing under his watch would outstrip that of his predecessors, who he likes to disparage. And that marked a change in his rhetoric and policy. I mean, before he came to power, he promised to tackle disappearances. It was something that he made a big part of his campaign. And when he first got into office, his government started to do really good things. I mean, it set up the National Center for Human Identification and said it would start a database to match DNA from the bodies that were found with that of their relatives to identify these bodies and these missing people. He also increased the budget for the National Search Commission, which is a government agency tasked with finding disappeared people. It rose by more than 40% between 2022 and 2023. But more recently, he's done an about turn on all of this.
How so?
So the government has gutted the identification centre, and of their 59 forensic specialists, and that's very few, frankly, 40 have been laid off. And the new census, as we talked about earlier, has come out with far lower numbers, which many see as manipulating them. I mean, dropping from more than 100,000 to just over 12,000 confirmed, and that's confirmed, the government saying it might be more, is a huge drop. The boss of the National Search Commission resigned last year in protest at the census, and the new one is widely thought to be unqualified, just someone who's been put there to fill the position. And so this suggests that the government is not committed to doing anything about the situation.
Should we be trusting the government's numbers on how many people are missing?
Well, getting accurate numbers is very difficult. I mean, lots of people say that the number in the register is not entirely correct. You know, there are some records that are in there twice, or people who've turned up and their record still sits in the register. But far more of a problem is the underreporting. So there are lots of people who don't report their relatives missing, or who try to and the authorities simply refuse to accept the report. So the original register figure of over 110, almost 111,000, was likely to be an underreporting of the situation anyway. Many people say it's 3 times that amount. And so the new census figure really does seem that it's incredibly low compared to what's happening on the ground.
Aren't families of the missing people putting pressure on the government?
Yeah, I mean, they are all the time. There's protests, there are posters all over the show. But really, they tend to get ignored. Few Mexicans pay attention beyond those with relatives who are missing to the problem. Last month, demonstrators knocked down one of the doors of the presidential palace with a truck. They were relatives and peers and friends of 43 trainee teachers who were abducted in 2014 from Ayotzinapa, which is a town fairly close to Mexico City. It's a case that's become emblematic of the disappeared people. It's never been solved, although almost all are almost certainly dead. And there's evidence that state authorities, state forces were involved in the abduction. And there's been attempts to cover up any form of proper investigation. So when it comes to the census data, arguments around the numbers risk drawing attention away from the main issue, which is that tens of thousands of people, likely, are missing and more go missing every day, and that the authorities are not looking for them.
But their families are.
Indeed, it falls to the collectives of families to search for them, like the one that Maria heads in Sinaloa. When I met her, it was in the edge of a field where she and several other relatives had just completed a search, and they'd found a body.
Ahí vamos, ahí buscamos, y estos son los resultados. Nosotros somos las que los encontramos.
She says, we're the ones who find them, we're the ones who locate them. It's the family members who go out and, having trained themselves, conduct searches to find where people might be. So in summary, the president is undoing what progress he really had made to help these families. He's right that accurate information is needed. Mexico needs to know how many people are missing. But he appears to be bending that goal to suit his own political ends.
Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much.
It's time to play America's favorite jackpot game. This is Powerball. Hello, America. Thank you for your patience. The Powerball.
Last Saturday, millions of Americans watched as six numbered ping pong balls tumbled out of a giant popcorn popper. The occasion was the drawing of Powerball, a multi-state lottery. That draw offered punters a shot at a $1.3 billion jackpot, the fourth biggest in the game's 32-year history. And for the first time since January 1st, someone won the jackpot.
Well, Powerball's three-month-long losing streak this morning has come to an end.
The winning ticket for last night's $1.3 billion jackpot was sold in Oregon.
Dang it!
I know.
That very lucky winner beat odds of one in 292 million. The Economist has been looking into who is buying all these tickets. And given such staggeringly low odds, why?
Last year, Americans spent more than $100 billion on state-run lotteries. Were they a single company, American Lotteries would be the ninth most profitable in the country.
Doug Dowson is a data journalist for The Economist.
States like these games because they generate government revenues. The problem is that they do so in a very regressive way.
Regressive how?
So poor households spend more on lotteries than richer ones. This has been pretty well known for a while. But the evidence for this has typically come from surveys. And we wondered whether we could find sales data to look into just how regressive these lotteries are. So to find out, we submitted records requests to the state lottery commissions asking for detailed zip code level sales data. And all told, we were able to compile data from 24 states. And when we crunched the numbers, we found that they are very regressive. Each 10% decrease in household income is associated with a 4% increase in lottery and spending. So as household incomes go down, spending goes up. Other variables we found mattered too, like age and race, but income seems to be the most important factor.
And give us a sense of numbers here. How much exactly are people spending on tickets?
We found that in the poorest 1% of zip codes with lottery retailers, American adults spend about $600 a year on average, or about 5% of their household income. In the richest 1% of zip codes, meanwhile, residents spend just $150 a year, or about 0.15% of their income. So this suggests that as a share of income, the poorest Americans spend around 30 times more on lotteries than the richest ones. And it turns out that during the pandemic, when a lot of folks received stimulus checks, this gap between spending from the well-off folks and the poorer folks actually increased.
So, Doug, help me here. Poorer people are playing more often despite the overwhelming odds that it will just make them poorer. Well, then why do it?
So there are a few reasons. First, these lotteries are everywhere. They're in 45 states and Washington, D.C. They're also a cheap form of entertainment. And over the years, games have been tweaked to lower the odds and boost jackpots, which makes playing them more exciting. And even the smaller prizes can be fun. On the days when nobody wins the big Powerball or Mega Millions jackpots, there are always a handful of people who win smaller million-dollar prizes. One of our colleagues actually won last week. She bought a ticket when there was the big jackpot and won $8. So she made her money back four times over. And so even though the chance of winning the jackpot is small, it's still possible, as the $1.3 billion winner last Saturday proves.
I'm glad that you didn't name the colleagues so I didn't go and rob them of their $8. But Doug, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Ari.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show. you can get in touch at podcast@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
As our world becomes increasingly interconnected, so do the risks we face. But with the right context, we can uncover deeper meaning. Moody's decodes risk so that you can act with confidence. Visit Moody's.com to see how your organization can decode risk and unlock opportunity.